You're listening to Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. Coming up next, we have a piece coming out of our friends at CIFA Radio in Prince George, BC. This one is about a local professor at the university in Prince George at UNBC speaking about a climate conversations podcast that they created. Take a listen.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca. Joining us over the line today is UMBC professor Dr. Joseph Shea. He's an associate professor of geography here at the University of Northern British Columbia and the Northern Studies Acting Program Coordinator therein. That's one thing, but he's also one half of folk music duo Trundled. With his partner Ellen Braun, residents of Northern BC may have had the opportunity to see the duo at various events and festivals in the region. But between that creative endeavor, Dr. Shea has also initiated a podcast called The Climate Conversations, which happened to have just started airing here on CIFA Radio 88.7 FM. This podcast series focuses on academics and experts local to Prince George Clayley Tanay, who have focused their academic expertise and research on this nebulous entity of climate change. These conversations cut across all sorts of disciplines, with research being conducted in all sorts of areas, as is necessitated by Dr. Shea's areas of interest, focusing on snow, glaciers, hydrology, mountains, UAVs or unmanned aerial vehicles, remote sensing, satellite imagery, and of course, climate change.
Thanks, Ian. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. And you're calling in today from Canmore, which is full of glaciers and all kinds of activity. But you've been traveling quite a bit doing your research. Where has your research taken you so far this summer?
This summer, it has been exclusively in British Columbia. I did about a week of field work in sort of the Robson Valley, Mount Robson Provincial Park, Vail Mount area. And then I did another few days down south of Golden in the Purcell Mountains. So it's all within D.C., not too exotic locales, but actually really impressive places to go and visit.
And certainly significant in terms of actually witnessing what something like climate change really looks like tangibly on the ground. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I kind of maybe have been desensitized, or I take it for granted, but when you get up into these alpine environments, the signals of climate change are so obvious and in your face, like it's really hard to ignore.
Within the work you do, obviously you mentioned you kind of become desensitized to some of this stuff because it's your day-to-day, it's your in and out. But what kind of inspired you to start this podcast, chat with other academics in various different fields about this topic? Do you feel like you're kind of a little too narrowly focused on it sometimes?
There's only so much I can do in the research field, but I think this actually came out of a Senate motion that one of my colleagues, Peter Jackson, launched a few years ago that got approved, where the UNBC Senate declared a climate emergency, which is basically to recognize the seriousness of climate change. And, you know, it's not just a symbolic gesture. It sort of would then encourage the university to think about climate change and any decisions that they make, right? So whether that's energy efficiency or new buildings or any sort of decision that's made financially should somehow consider climate change. So this came out, I think this was 2021. It's sort of blurry because of the pandemic, but I think that's when the motion was approved. So we started talking to the faculty about why don't we have like a climate change course that anyone can take. You know, there was a course on climate change in the fourth year environmental science program here that was very math heavy and sort of intensive and not really accessible to most of the students on campus. And so the idea that we pitched to the Faculty of Environment maybe 2022 or even 2023 was about let's launch a climate change course that students at the university could take from across all the faculties. Because, you know, we're the Green University, and I think it would be great to have students graduating from this university with knowledge of climate change and just sort of general background knowledge, a little bit on the science and the impacts of it in sort of the physical sense, but also how do we deal with it? What are the options for adaptation and mitigation? And so that's where this podcast came out of, was we got to talk to people across campus and see what they're doing and how they approach climate change and where it intersects with their research or their teaching. And so it turned into this podcast where I sent out a general call to all the faculties, and whoever wrote back, I said, great, let's set a time and sit down to meet. And so we filmed 14 different interviews with a faculty from across campus, and that's the podcast.
Another conversation you had with Dr. Nancy Stevens, who's the chair of First Nations Studies here at UMBC. She also has extensive experience in social work as well. And one of the things she mentioned in your conversations was that when it comes to your general overall wellness and, you know, making yourself feel okay so that you can go forward and tackle the problems of the day, sometimes just that looming aspect of climate change is hanging over you, and to just not address it, it doesn't really help you in any way. you kind of have to start addressing climate change in order to do other things. And did that conversation kind of enlighten you, or is it something you've been thinking about quite a bit as well? Just that directly observing the scientific aspects of climate change and the measurable changes that you can see in the work you do is certainly one thing. But I guess pumping yourself up to do it is another. I don't know. Do you want to explore that a little?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it was a big conversation I had with Nancy, and I think one of the, was this a direct quote? Action is the antidote to despair. I think that was one of the things that we sort of landed on. And mm-hmm. I think that is true. You know, like, I think subjects like this are inherently depressing. If you think about the current trajectory of things and how action has been so limited and so... actually doing something tangible is one way to sort of stave off those feelings of, helplessness or despair or inaction, you know, just sort of breeds, I don't know, despondency. Maybe that's another way of putting it. But yeah, it's it was an interesting discussion, and the theme of sort of doing something or even like getting outside shows up in a lot of these interviews, which I thought was pretty fascinating. It's one of the things you can, I was kind of asking questions about it, like what do you do or what do you think students could do? But everyone kind of suggested that things like literally getting outside and touching grass is a great way to reconnect and think a bit more about the natural world. And I really appreciate that, those perspectives from the different disciplines, because in our program, we talk about experiential learning, and we try and get students outside to see things sort of firsthand. And almost universally, students say that they've just learned so much in a field school, or, you know, these different field trips really brought home the messages that we're trying to get across in lectures and in classrooms. So, we see it from an educational perspective, but just in general, you know, doing something, getting outside is a great way to, I guess, pump yourself up for dealing with the situation.
Certainly. And as in terms of the variety of disciplines and topics that are featured in this podcast, you don't necessarily just focus on the Department of Geography. It's not as if your average listener to this podcast requires a Bachelor of Science to understand what's going on. The people you're talking to are not just, you know, academics and researchers, but they're also educators. They're used to explaining ideas in ways that are accessible. Was that a focus of this podcast, you know, pre-interview? Did you have to kind of get ready and like dial some things down and just be like, remember who our audience is here? We're trying to make this accessible. Or how did that go?
It was fairly natural, actually. I think people coming in had a sense of what this was for, right? We were going to be interviewing them, talking about their interests and their research, but not just their research, but climate change sort of in general, how it intersects in their lives or their teaching. And everyone, I think you're right, it's a great observation. They're all educators. And so they naturally sort of use language that I think is easy to understand for general listeners. Like, we weren't looking for an academic podcast, even though we're talking to academics. We wanted something that's accessible to everyone and is, you know, covers the broad spectrum of disciplines that UNBC engages in with research and teaching. And then we ended up with that. You know, we didn't want it to just be geography, people talking about geography things, even though, you know, I'm a bit biased and I think that's great. But I love the variety of people that we interviewed and the different interests that we talked about. And the episodes that are going to be coming out over the next 2 months really, really highlight some of the great work that's being done at UNBC and how climate change really does intersect with a lot of other different things.
You know, this is a project. There are stated goals and objectives. But for you personally, what are you hoping to achieve out of this project? What are you hoping people take away from, you know, any one of the podcast episodes or as a whole?
This wasn't about sort of boosting UNBC, but that's a really nice side effect of the podcast. You know, we're exposing audiences to what goes on up here at the university. And personally, I was interested in having these conversations. Like, I know these people as sort of colleagues, but we don't, you know, we try to avoid being in our silos, but it's really unavoidable in some way. You've got to get your research done and your teaching done, and you're limited in terms of how, you know, how much time you have to devote to exploring the other disciplines, what other people are doing on campus. So for me, this was great. I got to talk to people from all over the place about what they do, and found that really fascinating. You know, the only other time I can think of this happening is when we were on the strike line in 2019, and you're on a picket with people from other departments, and you end up talking to them about what they do. So for me, this was a great eye-opener. I hope people listening to it can take away nuggets from all the different episodes. Maybe it's something that they're interested in, these ideas of what we can do to sort of counteract the despair and where the action might be best focused. Really, it's just broader awareness of climate change and how people are approaching it and dealing with it.
So you've got 14 episodes. They're featured here on C4 Radio, Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Where can people find these podcasts, and what can they look forward to?
Okay, so the podcasts are also on YouTube. So the university has a playlist. You can see all the videos. It's also on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, and it seems to have been picked up by a few other aggregators. I'm not sure. I didn't push them to those places, but they're showing up in other places as well. So it's just called The Climate Conversations. We have 4 episodes now, so there's 10 more to come. And at this point, I do have to recognize that the funding for this project, because we, you know, it's not cheap to record and do all this production work, actually came from the UNBC Council of Deans. So that's an internal grant process, and then some additional funds were kicked in by the Faculty of Environment and the Department of Geography, Earth, and Environmental Science. So all together, that gave us the pool that we were able to use to produce this work. So you can catch it on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and coming up this week, we have an interview with Lorraine Lavallee, a social psychologist at the university. So talking about some psychology of our, you know, our actions and our motivations. That was a pretty fascinating talk. We have more chats with people from the Faculty of Education, like Dr. Alex Lautensack, Dr. Herb Bannock. We talk with Anne Duong, sustainability coordinator at the university, and Dr. Tristan Pierce, a colleague in the Faculty of Environment, Dr. Zoe Miletus, another colleague in the Faculty of Environment. So again, broad range of topics, diversity of speakers. I had a lot of fun doing it. It was a bit draining to do 4 of these in a day because we tried to group all the filming together. But oh my goodness. They all came out pretty well, I think. If anyone's listening to this or paying attention to the podcast, is try and chip in. Like, I would love to have sort of online dialogue if that's possible. So make your comments on the YouTube or the Apple Podcasts or the Spotify, and I'll try and address them. And if anyone wants to email me about it, they're more than welcome to do that. It's joseph.shea, so joseph.shea at unbc.ca.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for your time today.
You're welcome.
Tune in Tuesdays and Wednesdays here on C4 88.7 FM. If you want to hear the Climate Conversations, check it out on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and any podcast aggregator. Good luck with the rest of research in the beginning of what will surely be a busy semester. Yeah, travel well. Best of luck.
Thanks, Ian.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for C4 Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or CFUR.ca.
This is Bird Note. Some birds have always called nocturnally, such as nightjars, mockingbirds, and owls. But other species are relative newcomers to the nighttime music scene, especially in urban areas. In cities in the U.S., some American robins put on a show long before sunrise. Researchers are studying why certain songbirds sing nocturnally in cities. Some studies suggest that artificial lighting from street lamps and buildings could lead birds to treat the night like the day. However, some experiments with artificial lights showed no effect on singing behavior. For some birds, it seems that noise is an important factor. A study in the United Kingdom found that European robins in noisier environments tend to sing at night. The finding suggests that these robins experience nighttime as the best time to have their voice heard by potential mates and rivals after the day's hustle and bustle. Whatever the cause, birds singing at night are one more thing, like rumbling trains and passing cars, that city dwellers learn to sleep through. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Did you know you can listen to Bird Note in your podcast app? Subscribe to Bird Note Daily and never miss an episode.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. In 2012, Superstorm Sandy caused record-setting storm surge flooding in New York City. The devastating event prompted city officials to invest in protecting the city from future storms.
What we see is that people tend to prepare for extreme weather after they've experienced extreme weather.
But Aaron Coughlin de Perez of Tufts University says that as climate change causes more extreme weather, cities should not wait for that kind of terrible wake-up call to get prepared. In a 2025 study, she and co-authors used climate models to identify possible but never-before-seen events across several cities. For example, in Montgomery County, Alabama, models show that a future heat wave could reach almost 110 degrees, and an early spring storm could drop more than 8 inches of rain in a single day.
The goal of this modeling is to try to show people, here are examples of events that you probably want to prepare for, and try to help with that imagination of how the event could unfold and what we need to do to be ready in advance.
She says if people use past disasters as their guide for what to expect,
then we're driving forward while looking in the rearview mirror.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. This is your host for the hour, Danny Nesvedarani. We have about 12 minutes left in the hour. Before we get into that, just want to mention a campaign launch that is happening in just a few minutes down at Vancouver City Hall. This is with the charity Women Transforming Cities, which works towards shifting the social, economic, and political power within City Hall to equity-deserving groups. And they recently put out a survey asking Vancouver residents to talk about what they want prioritized for their city council members and just city council and just the city in general. And they put out the findings for that, and it's going to be talked about more at the campaign launch event. But some of the specific things that they mentioned as being important, some of the top themes that they received from this survey were things such as housing affordability. It was seen as the number one issue for residents who responded to the survey. It was mentioned by 86% of survey respondents as the top action needed. Second was transportation and mobility, especially more affordable, reliable, and faster buses, affordable community gathering spaces, food security, and more public washrooms and social services were determined as strong priorities, especially within community workshops that they ran. This has changed a little bit since their engagement that they did back in the 2022 municipal election, where it was determined that non-market housing, free and low-cost transportation, and public washrooms were also considered to be a high priority. But things such as food security and community gathering spaces are seen as even higher of priority compared to that of 2022. They're going to be talking about this and much, much more at the campaign launch event at Vancouver City Hall. So if you're able, go check that out. But if you're not able, we'll be attending that as well today. So we will have a report on what is talked about very, very soon. All right. Thank you all so much for tuning again to Speak Up. We are going to be playing another piece from our friends at CHLY. This is from their Comox Valley reporter, Jeannie Lynn, on how Comox Valley gathered to commemorate the 25th International Overdose Awareness Day. Take a listen.
This is a CHLY and Dig FM news update. On August 27th, community members gathered at the Comox Valley Art Gallery ahead of International Overdose Awareness Day on August 31st. The annual observance provides an opportunity for communities to recognize the grief experienced by families and friends who have lost loved ones as a result of an overdose. Founded in Australia in 2001, International Overdose Awareness Day aims to raise awareness about drug overdoses, reduce stigma, and remember those whose lives have been affected by the crisis. The day brings communities together through events across Canada, allowing families to share stories and show support for each other.
It's about allowing a space for us to really see and connect with each other. We heal in community. This is grief, this is loss, and it's deep. You know, people have lost their children. Myself, like I've mentioned, you know, I've lost a sibling. There's just so many people in the community that this has affected, and we really need a place to gather.
That was Amanda Larrabee, a member of Healing Hearts Canada, an organization that offers support for Canadian families who have lost loved ones due to substance use-related harms. Larrabee lost her brother to the crisis in 2018. She now works as a grief and loss facilitator with the Comox Valley chapter, supporting others in the community through the loss of loved ones.
This is 25 years of this particular event happening globally. So this is a global event. But in British Columbia, this is also the 10th year of a public health emergency that was declared in 2016. So we've got these two like strange milestone kind of dates, it really begs you to kind of question and think about, like, what are we doing? We've been a decade into, you know, essentially BC being in a public health emergency crisis over this, and we're not seeing government moving fast enough.
According to BC EHS, the city of Courtney recorded 462 paramedic responses to overdoses in the community in 2025, and the town of Comox recorded 28. Larrabee says that there are still gaps that need to be filled when it comes to preventative care and that government action is urgent.
A lot of people who use drugs. There's people who are weekend warriors and first-time users and regular users and binge users. And a lot of people use drugs for a lot of different reasons. And there's folks then, of course, that use more consistently and regularly. And so everybody on that spectrum is vulnerable. Everybody on that spectrum is at risk. And this is the crisis that we're in. And so we need government to step up. We've been here for 10 years.
According to BC's Help Starts Here, overdoses are preventable, and there are steps people can take to reduce risks and help save lives. One of those steps is learning how to use naloxone, a medication that can temporarily reverse an opioid overdose. Residents are encouraged to carry an naloxone kit and learn how to administer it. Larrabee says that one of the goals of the day is to challenge the stigma of those who are affected by the crisis.
My brother had a very good job, and he, you know, had a wonderful vehicle and drove an expensive BMW. And, you know, we automatically, I think as society, we're still looking at the most vulnerable people and who are the most vulnerable and need so many supports and so much care. But we're looking at this crisis as like only, you know, folks who may be unfortunately unhoused, right? There's the statistics say that the more people that are dying from this are housed. They're folks that are, you know, middle class, working people.
She says there are many people in the Comox Valley working to support those affected by the crisis.
Just love folks to know that there's a really strong and caring community here in the Comox Valley. There's a lot of people who are doing a lot of work to really make change.
For CHLY and Dig FM in Comox, I'm Jeannie Lin.
This report was made with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs podcast, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.
Thank you again to CHLY and Jeannie Lin for that piece on the 25th International Overdose Awareness Day, and just, I guess, the way that it was being commemorated in the Comox Valley. We're going to be ending off today's episode of Speak Up with just one more track. This one is from local band Whack. This one's titled Hard in What City. Thank you all so much for tuning in today to this episode of Speak Up. Make sure you tune in tomorrow again for Intravenous with Public Affairs and Talk Coordinator Nicole Hines. And then again on Thursday for Speak Up with Jesse, our programming coordinator here at CJSF. Democracy Now! Is in a few minutes. Make sure you stay tuned.
Baby, you.